This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this week's programme, we're asking why the government has lifted the cap on public sector pay. Please let us know what you think about this programme. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Do subscribe to the whole series, and if you're minded to, recommend us to your friends or your enemies. They may need us more. That's a pile of crap, and it's not good enough, was the blunt reaction of the PCS union boss, Mark Sawatka, to the news that the government was lifting its 1% cap on public sector pay for police and prison officers in England and Wales. Back in 2010, in the wake of the Great Crash, a new coalition government announced the idea of the cap like this.
I know there are many dedicated public sector workers who work very hard and did not cause the recession, but they must share the burden as we pay to clean it up.
7 years on, the question we're asking this week is what will happen if the pay cap is lifted for all public sector workers? And if it is, how much should it be lifted? And for who? And who pays? Step into the briefing room and find out. First into the briefing room is the BBC's Ruth Alexander, who looks at what's happened to public sector pay since 2010.
Back in 2010, riots on the streets of Athens formed the backdrop to political debate in Britain.
Greece stands as a warning of what happens to countries that lose their credibility or whose governments pretend that difficult decisions can somehow be avoided.
2 years earlier, the global banking collapse and following recession meant the UK government started borrowing record amounts. By the time the coalition government led by David Cameron took over in 2010, annual public borrowing had reached a post-war peak of more than £150 billion, equivalent to almost 10% of the country's gross domestic product, or GDP. The Chancellor, George Osborne, held an emergency budget and announced an austerity programme of tax rises and spending cuts. His aim, a vain one in the end, it turned out, was to balance the books within 5 years. And he asked for people's help.
In this budget, everyone will be asked to contribute. But in return, we make this commitment. Everyone will share in the rewards when we succeed. When we say we're all in this together, we mean it.
The contribution that George Osborne asked for from public sector workers was a pay freeze. The freeze lasted until 2013. It was then followed by a 1% cap on pay increases, which stayed in place until this week. So what did that actually mean for people? The Royal College of Nursing says that a nurse on an average salary of about £27,500 in 2010 would now be on just over £1,200 more, about £28,750. Sounds OK, until you remember inflation. Because of inflation, that amounts to a real terms pay cut of £3,780. And that has caused the current government a big headache.
My wage slips from 2009 reflect exactly what I'm earning today. So how can that be fair in light of what the job that we actually do?
and I recognise the job that you do. But we have had to take some hard choices across the public sector in relation to public sector pay restraint. And I'm being honest with you in terms of saying that we will put more money into the NHS, but there isn't a magic money tree that we can shake that suddenly provides for everything that people want.
This was the awkward moment during the general election campaign this June when Theresa May was confronted by a nurse over her salary. Following the election result, the political mood around austerity shifted. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, said the public were weary of the hard slog, and Cabinet members began hinting that the public sector pay cap could be lifted. This week, those hints turned into reality. This was Theresa May at Prime Minister's Questions.
There is a need for greater flexibility as we look at these issues of public sector pay in the future.
So far, that flexibility has included putting up the pay of police and prison officers in England and Wales, but by less than inflation, so they're still effectively getting a pay cut. And it seems unlikely that the clamour for more pay in the public sector will end there. With the budget looming in November, nurses, teachers, firefighters and others will be making their case.
No cherry-picking. All public servants deserve a pay rise, and they deserve it now.
Now, if you don't work in the public sector, why should any of this matter to you? Well, some economists argue that if public sector workers were paid more, they'd go out and spend that money and boost the economy. There's also a concern that the pay cap has affected the recruitment and retention of staff, threatening the quality of public services. Although there is a debate about whether people in the private sector do earn more than those in the public sector, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which we'll be hearing from later in the programme, calculates that public sector pay is on average higher than private sector pay, although in recent years that gap has been narrowing, and that's a trend that's likely to continue.
Ruth Alexander. The government is hoping that lifting the cap will help with both recruitment and retention of police and prison officers. But will it work? And at what cost? We're going to look at both sectors now in a bit more detail. In a moment, I'll speak to the former Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, Sir Peter Fye. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Amy Ludlow, lecturer in law at the University of Cambridge's Prison Research Centre. What impact has the public sector pay cap had, do you think, on prison officers?
Pay is a really important component of rewarding and motivating staff. There is an important question about whether prison staff who do a really important and often invisible job, whether they're adequately rewarded. But actually the problem in prisons in particular has been a reduction in terms and conditions for staff, which has meant we've got now fewer staff and the reduction particularly of experienced staff who left under voluntary redundancy packages, alongside staff who are new starters feeling like they're not adequately rewarded for quite challenging work. So pay has reduced for frontline new recruit officers to levels where it's just not retaining those staff in that role.
There are therefore two factors at play there. Even if you'd had higher levels of pay for prison officers, you would still have had two problems. One, that you were reducing the number of prison officers in any case, and two, that in the act of so reducing them, you were getting rid of quite a lot of more experienced staff. Is that right?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is changes to the sort of types and experience of order in prison. So the increase in suicide, in violence, are sort of consequences, byproducts of experienced staff leaving the landing. So what's been set in motion is a bit of a vicious cycle, which is that you have new staff coming in on poorer terms and conditions, coming into environments that feel increasingly sort of unstable and complex and difficult, thinking, actually, I could probably have a more straightforward life working in a different sector where I'm feeling sort of better rewarded and not having some of the risks that come with prison work, and so leaving. So you've got a sort of high churn which then escalates the problems of disorder, because we haven't got enough staff in some of our prisons to facilitate even the basics for people in their care. So there are some establishments, we have situations where staff are having to be deployed from elsewhere just to make the prison basics run.
To what extent do you think that lifting the pay cap and paying officers a bit more would actually alter the things that you've described?
So I think symbolically it's really important, but pay alone is inadequate. So what's needed is around professionalisation. So it's about training, it's about adequate numbers of staff. You know, there's no point having five members of staff on a landing if they are better paid. If actually to make that landing run, you need more like seven. So we've got to have a proper conversation about numbers and quality. At times of austerity and pressure on public resources, actually a smaller prison population would be one significant way of cost saving, which would enable those cost savings then potentially to be invested in better environments that we know there's lots of research evidence to show that local smaller prisons do better. We know lots now about the sorts of programmes and things that could be invested in to help people live better lives that include not causing more victims sort of post-release. Pay is one factor, but that has to come alongside serious conversations about professionalisation, about the size of our prison population and about numbers of staffing. We need to have the right number of staff in place.
Dr. Amy Ludlow. With me now is Sir Peter Fay to talk about the police. Sir Peter, in your perception, is there a real problem with pay making it difficult to retain or recruit police officers?
There is, sadly. You can see it in the numbers of officers that are leaving mid-service, many complaining of poor morale and the pressure of work. And that's seemingly similar to what we're seeing within teaching and in the health service. Experienced staff got much to offer, but certainly feeling the broader context of working in the public service, pressure of work, and sometimes things like the accountability regimes, meaning that they are seeing other forms of employment more attractive.
Now, the things that you're mentioning there actually aren't necessarily pay related. They are to do with how alterations to their terms and conditions are impacting upon them. What about pay itself?
Well, pay is an issue. I think certainly what you're seeing in policing is lots of good officers who can't see the opportunities to progress. There is a reality about the level of public spending available, but I don't think what we've seen certainly in policing is the level of reform to the pay system, which will allow chief constables and police and crime commissioners to make the sort of changes they need to make to keep policing going and to deal with more complex demands on policing. And in the same time, they don't have really the levers to try and motivate and encourage and reward really good police officers who are building their expertise.
We've had this announcement that the pay cap will be lifted, the pay cap of 1%. What impact do you think that will have on the kinds of problems you're talking about?
I don't think it will have any impact at all, really. I think the danger is it may seem as insulting to some police officers, and certainly it will put more pressure on police forces because they are having to fund themselves this pay increase. The vast majority of a police budget is spent on staff, and therefore, if a police force has to give more in salaries to existing staff, and probably they're going to have to reduce the overall level of staffing to provide that money. There are often very few alternatives, particularly when police forces have been through 4, 5, 6 years of austerity already and already had to make difficult cuts. What we're seeing in things like policing and in lots of other forms of the public service is that the demands are becoming more and more complex. The social problems, the crime problems, the levels of accountability that police officers have to perform at. And therefore, you need a pay system which will reward those officers who are building up their professionalism, building up their expertise, so that, for instance, really good, hard-working detectives who build up their expertise can get rewarded for that without having necessarily to go into the traditional promotion scheme. To be fair, as happens in teaching and nursing, where they have made efforts to make sure that good nurses and good teachers stay in the wards and stay in the classrooms.
So what kind of reforms would we be talking about?
Well, what you see generally, I think, in most successful organisations, that there are flattening hierarchies and realising that you need to have sometimes a smaller number of better qualified staff who are rewarded for their expertise. And that's what you see in policing. Policing is becoming more and more complex on things like cybercrime, dealing with vulnerable people, investigations into sexual offences. And so, really, the level you need a police officer to operate is very similar to a nurse, to a social worker, to a teacher. And you need a system of reward which recognises that level of expertise. But at the moment, the police pay system on the whole just recognises the length of service and your position in the hierarchy.
Sir Peter Fahey, in this debate we get to hear mention of independent pay review bodies reporting to government. But what are they? Joining me now is Jerry Cope, who chaired two pay review bodies, one on the NHS and another on the prison service. So how do you go about your work? I mean, how do you go about gathering evidence about the conclusions you ought to reach?
Well, the first thing we do is usually in the summer, we go and visit the establishments that we're interested in. So I've been round 40 prisons for my sins, been round lots of NHS establishments, and we talk to staff, we talk to managers, and we try to find out what are the things that concerning them in pay and pay-related issues.
Well, I don't know whether you'll get anybody ever telling you they wanted less.
No, but we do get people saying that maybe training is more important than pay, that maybe getting the staffing levels right is more important to them than maybe an extra 0.5% on their pay. So it's that sort of balance that we're looking for. Basically, we get triggered by government to start the round, and we then call for evidence from all stakeholders, and they provide us with a lot of written evidence. So we call them in for oral evidence.
So how do you come up with the final report? What are you asked effectively to balance in your final report?
There are three things we're asked to balance, and we keep in mind one key issue. So if I take NHS as the example, the three things we're asked to balance are affordability, the commitment and motivation of staff, and recruitment and retention. But everything with a sort of patient-centric eye. So would it be good for the patients to have 10 more nurses or for those nurses to be paid another 1%? How would they feel in terms of their own motivation? Are they going to give better for patients because they get money? Or are they going to actually, as some of them say on our visits, what we want is our wards fully staffed. But of course, wards can't be fully staffed unless you get the pay levels right to attract people in.
So underlying it is the assumption that the departmental budget will always stay the same. You've been given a set amount of budget that you have to work within, and that provides you, if you like, the constraint, the parameter within which you make a judgment.
Yes, but of course, there are priorities within that budget. So we might say to the Department of Health, you seem to be spending a lot of money on this year. Don't you think actually it would be better spent on staff? There's quite a lot of flexibility in budgets, even though they're tight.
So have you ever been minded in any of your pay review bodies to suggest a 0% increase because actually when you looked at pay versus these other considerations, the other considerations came out on top?
Yes, we have. We do separate reports for Northern Ireland, for Scotland and for Wales and England combined. And for instance, in Northern Ireland, pay levels in the NHS are quite competitive in the economy. So we look very closely at a zero pay level there to help them fund extra staffing, which we felt we needed. We decided against it, but we looked at it.
Are there any flaws in the pay review body structure?
There aren't any intrinsic flaws, but I do get worried at the moment about whether all the parties are really going to continue to respect the process. For instance, the prison officers didn't give evidence in the last round to the prison pay review body, probably because they didn't like the answers that previous reports had come up with. And the whole point of having an independent body is that it gives a reasoned, absolutely unbiased judgment about what's appropriate in a particular year.
So, finally, isn't there a danger in a period when public sector pay is going to be increasingly contested that people representing the workers in those areas will want to withdraw cooperation from pay review bodies because they won't like the constraints under which you're forced to report?
Yeah, there is that danger, but not for the reason you said. We're not under any constraints. You've just seen in both the police and prison pay review bodies that they broke the government 1% pay policy, despite that constraint having been suggested to them in the initial evidence. So pay review bodies are not under a constraint. I think the danger arises with trade unions particularly don't think through their alternatives. It is pretty unlikely that there would be serious industrial action in the health service just because of the effect on patients, in which case it's very hard for them to prosecute their case other than through the review body. Actually, the trade unions need the pay review body system to work in order to get a reasonable result for their members.
Jerry Cope. So that's how it's done. Now let's look at the economic consequences of lifting the pay cap. The last briefer in the room is Paul Johnson, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Paul Johnson, how much will it cost to increase police and prison officers' pay as much as has been announced?
Well, the increases for police and prison officers aren't terribly big relative to the 1% increase that they were expecting, and they're not very big parts of the public sector. They're not the millions that you think of when you're talking about the NHS and the education service. So we're looking at a few tens of millions, maybe £100 million, which in the overall budget of the public sector isn't a very great deal. But because it's having, as I understand it, to come out of the police and prison service budgets, there will be serious and hard choices that the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice will have to make within that.
We heard Francis O'Grady earlier on in the Ruth Alexander package, head of the TUC, talk about no cherry picking. This needs to be applied across the board to public sector workers. So if we then apply this to all public sector workers, what do we get to in terms of cost?
Well, we spend about £180 billion a year paying public sector workers. It's the single biggest thing that government does, actually, and that's not surprising, given that what public services are the teachers and nurses and soldiers and policemen and so on. So for each 1% that you pay, that's well over £1.5 billion. If we're looking 3 or 4 years down the road, and suppose we were to increase public pay in line with prices or private sector earnings over that period, you could easily be at a cost of an additional £7, 8, or £9 billion a year. But of course, at some point, that is inevitable. You cannot continue to pay or increase pay in the public sector by less than you increase pay in the private sector.
But if you don't, at the very least, give them whatever inflation is, then in that case you're going to get the accusation which was launched by Jeremy Corbyn in Prime Minister's Question Time this week that it is actually a real terms pay cut.
That's absolutely right. If you increase pay by less than inflation, then it's a real pay cut. But remember, and I think this is really crucial in this whole debate, private sector workers are getting real terms pay cuts at the moment as well. With inflation at near enough 3% and average earnings only rising by about 2%, people across the economy and the private sector as well are doing badly. And if you look at the period since 2008, since the recession hit, the public sector has done no better and no worse on average than the private sector. It's not in a sense that they've been particularly singled out for harsh treatment. Everyone has had a miserable time over this period.
And this presumably is also what underpins the announcement this week of record employment rates. In other words, the paradox is, or one of the apparent paradoxes, we don't pay very much and as a result we have very low unemployment.
Yeah, it's a very complex relationship. The very good news of the last decade is that we've got record levels of employment and record low levels of unemployment. That's gone hand in hand with the worst decade for earnings growth, according to the governor of the Bank of England. I think he says the worst decade since the middle of the 18th century. Now, there's two things going on there. One is that the kinds of jobs that are being created are a bit different and lower paid. And secondly, and the really crucial underlying problem here, is that productivity is doing incredibly badly. For each hour that we work, we're producing on average no more than we were a decade ago. And that's an extraordinary period, something we've not experienced in a very long time indeed. Now, there's all sorts of things that underlie that: a lack of investment in the aftermath of the recession, a problem with the financial services sector making money available, and the fact that we seem to have a labour market which accepts these very low wages, which again allows low productivity companies to survive.
Since the Chancellor has said effectively that pay increases above the cap are going to have to come out of departmental budgets, if there were to be increases above the cap and, let's say, up to inflation on all public sector pay, what impact would that have on those budgets?
I think that would be very hard to achieve in some of those areas. We know, for example, that the National Health Service is really struggling with the amount of money that it's got at the moment. I think if the Chancellor, if the Prime Minister really wants nurses and doctors and so on to get a 3% pay rise, I think they will have to find more money for public services.
Now, we've learned that there's going to be a budget on the 22nd of November. Presumably, the Chancellor could come to the House on the 22nd of November and said, look, in order to be able to pay these pay increases, we're going to put up taxes.
He could say that. I mean, he has an obvious political problem, which is his lack of majority in the House, and he couldn't even get a very small tax increase through after the March budget. I mean, the other option, of course, that he always has is simply to borrow more to pay for additional spending. And he has deliberately left himself with a bit of wiggle room against his current set of fiscal targets. But he's left himself that wiggle room because he is worried, probably with good reason, about what might happen to the economy in the next 3 or 4 years.
One of the things that people used to talk about in the old days also was to try and get round this, to give employers more capacity to set local pay rates, to go to regional or local pay bargaining. People raised it all the time and it never happened. And I presume you think it never will.
Well, there's a very good intellectual case for at least having differential pay rates in different parts of the country. We know that public sector workers in London and the South East are incredibly badly paid relative to those in the private sector. But actually, public sector workers in Wales, Northern Ireland, some parts of the North and the Midlands are actually very, very well paid relative to those in the private sector. So there is a case for more differentiation. Now, I don't think there's a very strong case for sort of local or regional pay bargaining, but there is certainly a case for government saying we'll give maybe 3% to workers in London and the South East and 0% to those in the North. Now, that goes down very badly with workers in the North and very badly with unions and is taken as a sort of divide and rule approach. But actually, the case for it is reasonably strong. But as you say, it hasn't very often happened. And I think because of this sense that it's divisive, I think it may well not happen.
You've looked at how governments have responded over the years to various impulses. What's your guess about where this one is headed over the medium term?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously the reason that this is coming to a head now is partly political, but it is also partly because we've actually reached the point where public pay has got back down to where it was in 2008 relative to private pay. So unless you wanted a protracted period of public pay just falling further and further behind what's happening in the rest of the economy, this is probably the right moment economically as well as politically for thinking about change and for lifting that 1% cap. So my guess is we'll probably, I would guess, end up with pay settlements in the public sector over the next 2 or 3 years, which look more like those in the private sector and therefore are more like 2% than 1%. But with inflation where it is following the devaluation and the Brexit vote and so on, that may well still, I'm afraid, see real inflation-adjusted pay falling.
So that suggests that the public sector thing is actually almost a kind of diversion from the fact that we have very, very low wage growth and that something needs to be done to create better quality, higher paying jobs.
That is certainly right. It's important to talk about these two things together because we're often talking about public sector pay on the one hand, and then entirely separately, we're talking about what's happening to average pay and living standards on the other. Actually, you do have to think about the two of them together. And there's no question that the underlying problem in the economy is that productivity and wages across the economy are doing very badly. Now, you say we need to do something about it. I think there is a genuine problem that there is uncertainty about exactly what it is that you can do. Now, there is a kind of direct thing that government can do and is doing, which is to increase minimum wages. But beyond that, into the long run, it is increasing investment, education, skills and productivity that's going to make the difference.
Thanks, Paul. I think my quick summary would go something like this. Politically, it's obviously very hard for the government now to resist lifting the cap for other public sector workers. And though it might very well help, it won't necessarily resolve the problems of recruitment and retention of staff. And in addition, it's going to mean frontline services in other areas may very well have to be cut to pay for it. Well, my thanks to Ruth Alexander, Dr. Amy Ludlow, Sir Peter Fye, Jerry Cope and Paul Johnson. We'll be back at the same time next week. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.